Welcome back to the Tales of Two Cities podcast. Hello, everybody. I'm Brianna Flynn.
And I'm Kat Shuknick, and we will be your hosts this week. This week, we explore the Bay Area's fascinating and sometimes strange people, places, and creatures. Welcome to the Spaces episode. First up, we've got a special report from Brian Kranz on the Ghost Ship Fire, which tragically claimed more than 30 lives in East Oakland.
We have right now 36 families not only grieving for their lost ones, but also they want to have answers.
Then we'll hear about an East Oakland mural that's transforming the space around a community center.
This particular symbol represents a place where people can rejuvenate themselves, get resources. You know, a place where you can come and replenish yourself before you go on to the next stop. It's not just a hiding place.
And we've got a report on a heated governmental debate about the best way to stop illegal dumping in the East Bay.
It's not a dumping ground. You know, there's older people, younger people. We saw the community. We're here. We have to walk by trash every single day. It's affecting our health.
We take a trip up to Bodega Bay to find out what legacy's left at the shooting locations of Hitchcock's classic film, The Birds, 50 years later.
So in order to get rid of them, he gave them some outrageous demands. You want to rent my place? You'll have to call the town Bodega Bay in your movie. You'll have to call the restaurant The Tides in your movie, and you'll have to put me in the movie with a speaking role. He had one line, but he got everything he asked for.
And we'll speak with Al Burke and hear stories from his work as a storage space manager.
That's all coming up on the Tales of Two Cities podcast.
Our first story today is from reporter Brian Kranz, who's bringing us a special report on the tragic fire that cost more than 30 lives in East Oakland last week.
Jason Urbina wasn't expecting the Saturday morning he had.
So when I woke up, I had a couple friends text me, and they're just like, hey, are you live? Can you call me? Can you call me right now? And there's a lot of voice calls from my mom, my parents, a lot of my other homies.
They were concerned that the 27-year-old sound producer from Alameda had been at a warehouse called the Oakland Ghost Ship. A fire erupted during an electronic music party there.
People were hitting me up because I had marked attending on the list, but I actually stayed in SF the whole night.
The fire is the most fatal in Oakland's history. Here's Oakland Police spokesperson Officer Jonna Watson addressing the press on the morning of December 5th, updating the death toll to 36.
Right now, 36 families not only grieving for their lost ones, but also they want to have answers. And we as a city collectively are working to find those answers. We want to provide answers not only for the family, but for our community.
Meanwhile, authorities continue to sift through the debris.
There is a criminal investigation.
Melinda Drayton, an Oakland Battalion fire chief, said the size and scope of the blaze has made the investigation difficult.
We are no closer to finding a cause. And we absolutely believe that the number of fire fatalities will increase.
People across the Bay Area awaited news about their loved ones. Those listed among the departed include a middle school teacher, a sheriff's deputy's son, musicians, artists, and poets. Others are still missing, including Johnny Gass, a DJ who performed at the Ghost Ship the night of the fire. Friends are hoping for the best while fearing for the worst. Urbina says the area's music scene is undoubtedly impacted.
It definitely took a huge blow because Johnny was definitely a huge influence in the music community for as a teacher, as a mentor, as influence for other artists out there.
Artists live workspaces like the Ghost Ship are common in the Bay Area's alternative art and music scene. Increasing rents can force artists into less than ideal spaces, often sacrificing safety for survival. But even after the Ghost Ship fire, Urbina doesn't feel unsafe seeing a local show.
Honestly, you never know for anything. Anything could go either way. And they've held events like this millions of times.
This one, unfortunately, ended in tragedy. Reporting for the Tales of Two Cities podcast, I'm Brian Kranz.
Igaz's body was among 36 recovered from the scene. Reporter Ryan Lindsay covered the painting of a mural outside an Oakland community center and the way it's transforming Oaklanders' experience of the space.
Rifa and Batch are busy painting. They're changing the face of a former grocery store and pizza spot turned community center on 8th Street between Campbell and Willow. A series of multicolored triangles and squares fill the skies of cityscapes from Timbuktu and Oakland, and in the center, with her arms stretched to the sky, the audacious abolitionist, Harriet Tubman.
The center section is going to be a design motif dedicated to Harriet Tubman and her spirit of resistance and her love and commitment to freeing African people.
Incorporated throughout the panels is the color red, which Rifa says symbolizes the power and blood of people from the African diaspora, and a monkey wrench, a symbol used by slaves traveling on the Underground Railroad.
This particular symbol represents a place where people can rejuvenate themselves, get resources, you know, a place where you can come and replenish yourself before you go on to the next stop. It's not just a hiding place. And so it symbolizes something that we want to bring forward, you know, in the paintings that we create and the murals that, you know, they hold our culture. And it's a place that we can rejuvenate our spirits, our imaginations, and just our energy.
Currently, there aren't any words on the mural. Reef is saving the only word, love, for last.
We're going to do some lettering. It's going to say love. At the center of it all, that's what moves us. It's love for our people.
He started painting the mural during the middle of October. In November, Batch, a French artist he met 2 years ago in Dakar at Festigraph, an international graffiti festival, flew out from Paris to help. Batch was focused on finishing the panel with a black and white depiction of a little black girl with a splash of red behind her.
I have to make a little girl. She represents the futures. She's not scared, but she's not, how you say, confident? Confiance? It's the young generations looking forward. And there is a little sadness in his eyes because of the time we're living.
One day, weeks after Batch returned to Paris, two little girls, no older than 5, walked past the mural. One pointed at the face he'd painted and said, "That's me." Another day, a man stopped Rifa while he was painting. "Yo," he said, "I love your work. You're still out here doing it?" Rifa used to teach art to incarcerated youth, and he had met this young man a few years back when he was behind bars.
Oftentimes, I'll see some of the young people that I work with on the inside when they're out on the street. And them being able to see that the relationship that I started to build with them behind enemy lines is still strong when they get out of the clink and see us doing the same type of work in the neighborhood is refreshing to them in the sense that it's not just a job, this is a lifestyle. And also seeing that the relationships extend outside of the 9-to-5 professional context, that this is more about community building and them being able to actually see what it is that we speak to them about in these classes taking form in the communities that they live in.
He says the biggest part of creating murals is about creating dialogue.
I got to talk to a young couple the other day, and they spent about an hour here. And some might say, well, they distracted you from your work. But it's like, that's really what this is about. The murals are about that conversation. The murals are to communicate that sense of self-determination. And so people seeing you active in your community doing this type of work, to me, is just as important, if not more, than the actual final outcome of the visual art on the wall.
As the seasons change, Rifa faces delays in completing the mural. When it rains, he has to wait for the wall to dry. He also has less daylight now that it starts getting dark around 5 p.m. But Rifa says the mural is about more than just the finished product.
Having a space that has imagery that is reflective of the community, but also promoting ideas that are positive is important. And there's not enough of that, particularly in the African community, where we have images created by us, for us, that promote a narrative of self-determination, peace, love, strength, courage, and all the other beautiful things that speak to Black people's history here, African people's history in the world.
For the Tale of Two Cities podcast, I'm Ryan Lindsay.
Illegal dumping has been a hot topic in Oakland for more than 10 years, but residents in East Oakland say it's worse than ever. At a recent town hall meeting, community members expressed their frustrations to Mayor Libby Schaaf and City Councilmember Larry Reed. Brianna Flynn and Katie Parrish have the story.
600 voices.
Residents of East Oakland gathered at St. Louis Bertrand Church in early November to express frustration over illegal dumping in the streets. Mayor Libby Schaaf and City Council Member Larry Reed, who represents that district, fielded questions about the city's response to dumping complaints. The event was hosted by Oakland Community Organizations, a nonpartisan social justice group. Yazella Jimenez, a leader for the group, talked to Oakland North after the event.
I think that our families shouldn't live in this dumping ground. It's not a dumping ground. You know, there's older people, younger people. We saw the community. We're here. We have to walk by trash every single day. It's affecting our health.
Illegal dumping can include anything from abandoned cars to heaping hefty bags filled with trash to household furniture like mattresses and couches. In many instances, the dumping sites can be a health and safety issue for nearby residents because they can contain sharp objects such as glass and needles. Between October 2015 and 2016, more than 20,000 incidences of illegal dumping were reported to the Oakland Public Works Department. According to the city, that's a 92% increase since 2011. Here's what one panelist at the town hall had to say about the problem.
We are surrounded by this. If it's clean one day, 24 hours later, we've got it again. Is this enough? Is enough? Is this okay for our families to live in?
No! Audience members asked Mayor Schaaf and Councilmember Reed to make the consequences of illegal dumping more substantial. Currently, dumpers can be fined up to $1,000. But a new policy proposed that night by Oakland community organizations would require them to also have to clean up the streets. The mayor said she thought that could be a step in the right direction and said she understood people's frustration.
You know, Oaklanders have every right to be really angry about the level of dumping, illegal dumping, that is happening in this city. People are coming from outside of this city and dumping their trash on our streets, and no one should have to live with that.
The meeting concluded with a rendition of the traditional Spanish folk song, De Colores, led by Tony Valdivia and sung by children who attend the church.
De colores, de colores se visten los campos en la primavera. De colores, de colores son los pajarillos que vienen de afuera.
City officials said they would consider the policy after checking its legality with the city attorney's office. For now, it remains the idea stage. For Oakland North, I'm Brianna Flynn, with field reporting and audio engineering by Katie Parrish. You're listening to the Spaces episode on Tales of Two Cities.
For our next story, reporter Brad Bailey travels to Bodega Bay and back in time to when the birds took over Northern California. He explores the legacy of Alfred Hitchcock's classic film and the mark still left on the places it was filmed more than 50 years later.
The Birds is a 1963 American feature film directed by Alfred Hitchcock, based on the 1952 story of the same name by Daphne du Maurier. It focuses on a series of inexplicable violent bird attacks in a small coastal village over the course of a few days. The film stars Rod Taylor and Tippi Hedren, with Jessica Tandy, Suzanne Plachette, and Veronica Cartwright. A film setting is like an uncredited character, the omnipresent star of a movie. You can't forget the impact of the isolated Bates Motel in Psycho, or the foggy Golden Gate Bridge in Vertigo. Physical settings almost behave like a human character and can give insight into the central character's thoughts, or could be its own entity, creating an atmosphere for the film. Foggy, isolated, and coastal Bodega Bay served as the perfect backdrop for the Birds. It's a quiet fishing village with stunning vistas and a rocky coast. The town is located 60 miles north of San Francisco. Bodega is picture postcard beautiful, with rolling hills and a church steeple that overlooks the town. Our first visit is to the Bodega Country Store. The store, built in the 1860s, does double duty as the major general store and tourist attraction. There's a life-size Alfred Hitchcock outside, and it has the largest Hitchcock memorabilia in the country with over 400 items. We enter the store and have a chat with owner Michael Fahmy, who bought the place in 2008.
This store was built in the 1850s, and it's kind of stepping back into time. That this town, you don't see towns like this anymore. You don't see stores like the store we have here. So right now we have the collection, the Alfred Hitchcock collection, the largest collection of Hitchcock memorabilia. The movie was filmed here in 1962 and was released in 1963. So folks come from all over the world to check out the collection and check out the location of the movie.
And so what can you give me some of the aspects of your memorabilia here that stand out?
Well, there's a lot of original. There's a few original pieces from the movie, and we have a lot of the script, the artwork, promotional movie stills, original pieces autographed by Tippi Hedren. She's a regular guest of the store. She's here every Labor Day weekend. She comes to visit, and we always love to have her here.
We caught up with the star of the movie, Tippi Hedren, who at 86 is still the blonde bombshell. We got her thoughts about Bodega and Bodega Bay.
There's something magical about that area. Now, I can't explain it. I mean, you can't really explain magic. But I always felt like it was a thrill to be there. And we spent a great deal of time on the bay. There's a special feeling about that area that's absolutely delightful, whether it's early morning, noon, night, whatever. It's fascinating.
Bodega Bay has retained much of its authenticity from that era, and in many ways is unchanged. Fahmy talked about how the movie has impacted the character of the town.
Well, I think if you spend time here, and I don't mean just a quick in and out, just sit down on the porch and have something to drink, and it kind of slows you down, it kind of mellows you out. And you can probably have an idea, and you spend any time here, you may have an idea of what it was like living here in the Old West. And that's kind of what it is for me. You don't see towns like this, and you don't see stores like my store. So I try and have people kind of take it in. And this collection has kept the town going, and a lot of the fellow merchants and business people in the area really appreciate it being here. It's kept us alive.
We then head over to the Tides restaurant, scene of the climactic attack sequence in the film. We spoke to restaurant manager Mark Galazzo about how it almost never happened.
The fact that we were featured in that movie back in the 60s kind of was an accident. You know, there's like a local lore about Alfred Hitchcock had passed through, stopped here to have something to eat. The sky was overcast, which is the way you find it many times in the summer, gray skies. He was watching the birds that were nesting in the trees. The Brewer's blackbirds nest in our trees. Brewer's blackbirds will attack you if you go too close to their tree. Reminded him of the Daphne du Maurier story that he'd read once upon a time and always wanted to make a movie. That book takes place in England, in I believe it's Cornwall. The weather here reminded him of that. He approached the owner of the Tides, a man named Mitch Zankich back at the time, who didn't care about movies and was not interested at all in using his place in a movie. So in order to get rid of them, he gave them some outrageous demands. You want to rent my place? You'll have to call the town Bodega Bay in your movie. You'll have to call the restaurant The Tides in your movie, and you'll have to put me in the movie with a speaking role. He had one line, but he got everything he asked for.
Do you remember his line?
Yeah, what happened, Mitch?
That was his line. Also at The Tides was Melinda Paul, who staffs the Sonoma County Visitor Center. We talked about what Bodega Bay means to her.
What it means to me, though, is I have so many people coming through this town that I see every day. We see at least 100 people most days, some days up to 250 people here. And this town is still small, and it's a fishing village. That's what it really is. And I would like to see that identity retained here. It's so peaceful and quiet here. The weather is harsh. It's warm enough, but it can be very foggy here. Most of the time it's foggy in the summer. And that's what Alfred Hitchcock wanted. He wanted a gray depiction I've read that he, it was actually blue sky when he came out here, and that he had to actually Photoshop the pictures or airbrush the pictures to make it gray.
As we head out from town, we make a quick stop to Bodega Head. The peninsula is considered a prime spot to observe the migration of whales and a feeding ground for great white sharks. It's also a marine protected area and bird sanctuary. As we looked up at the stunning sunset, there was pink ribbon streaking across the horizon. At the same time, I noticed a flock of seagulls coming in from the coast, looking suspiciously down at us from the sky.
The music you just heard was Hitchcock Etude by composer Nicole Lisée and is performed by the Bozzini Quartet.
This week, Kat and I will be interviewing Al Burke about the storage space he manages in West Oakland and the people he meets on the job.
Okay, my name is Al Burke. I work at All Star Storage in Oakland. Been here for about 30 years. We used to be a moving company. Now we just do the storage. We're sort of a neighborhood thing. And I live in Hayward.
Awesome, Al. And can you tell us, your favorite part of, being the manager of a storage unit?
Actually, my favorite part of managing the storage place is the people I get to meet. There's people come in from all, walks of life. It's this neighborhood's going through a big transition right now, so it's a lot of different kinds of people. I have homeless customers, and I've got Piedmont attorneys, and some of them have been here as long as 30 years. I've been here a long time, and I do make friends with my customers. I know pretty much everybody's story. They know mine. If I meet somebody and I like them, we become friends. Sometimes it's just business. It just depends on the person.
That's great, Al. Is there any customer that stands out that you could tell us a little about?
A long time ago, one of the guys from Star Wars was a customer here. He literally had a self-storage here and a studio in Emeryville before the movies were made, and after that he moved to some big fancy mansion in Marin County.
It seems that people who use self-storage units might be at unusual junctures in their lives, that these might be kind of emotional moments for people. Do you think that is true? And if so, does that play a role in why you're able to cultivate relationships with customers?
A lot of people that we deal with are going through, they're moving. Things like back in the day when we had the Oakland fire, you had a lot of people who had very little left, but they wanted to store it. We get a lot of people, people pass away and we get their stuff while they decide how it's going to be split up. That does sometimes cultivate my friendship because I've been known to help people get through it. And I kind of like doing it and just goes with the job, I guess. There's two ways to do it. I could either do it that or I could just be like corporate drone guy. This is the rules. This is the way it goes. That wouldn't be any fun.
I'm wondering if you can talk or touch on, what storage spaces sort of represent in people's lives, just from your experience and what you've seen managing your space.
Everything. Storage could be anything to anybody. A lot of people, it's their extra bedroom. Some people, it's a place to put their winter clothes in the summer, summer clothes in the winter. Some people, it's just to hang on to things that they aren't ready to get rid of. A lot of times, we'll have people that get married or move, couples that move in together, and, somebody will have some stuff maybe that their new person doesn't want in the house, but they don't want to get rid of it until they're sure it works. There's a million different reasons to store.
All right. Thanks, Al. Take it easy. That's it for this episode of Tales of Two Cities. We hope you enjoyed our episode on spaces.
What did you enjoy listening to? Let us know. Comment on our SoundCloud account or write to us on Facebook by looking up our websites, Oakland North and Richmond Confidential.
Hey, you can even tweet at us. We're at North Oakland Now and at RI Confidential.
Our producer this week is Andrew Beal. Our music is by Kevin McLeod.
You can listen to our podcast on oaklandnorth.net, richmondconfidential.org, and on SoundCloud. And you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.
I'm Brianna Flynn.
And I'm Kat Schuknecht. Thanks for listening to the Tales of Two Cities podcast.